Good evening. We want to welcome you this evening to our discussion of C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. Some of you are listening by audio, some of you are watching by video, and we trust that our discussion this evening may be beneficial to us, beneficial to our church, and beneficial to all who may tune in and listen. The purpose of this discussion is really to orient our church and ourselves to the thinking of C.S. Lewis in preparation for a conference which will be at our church, God willing, April 30th and May 1st. The times of that conference are 9:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m., both on Saturday, April 30th, and Sunday, May 1st. And you can get a full schedule of speakers and topics by visiting our church website at firstbaptistparker.org and then clicking on the Inklings Conference. The conference will be webcasted live, both in audio and video. Of course, we'd rather have you join us personally for that, but if you cannot, we do encourage you to listen or watch. Again, this evening our purpose is to orient ourselves more to an understanding of C.S. Lewis, particularly his work, The Abolition of Man, in preparation for Dr. David Noggle's lecture on C.S. Lewis and the Abolition of Man. We will focus primarily on Chapter 1 because that is certainly the heart of what Lewis has to say in the work, The Abolition of Man. However, we'll pull from Chapters 2 and 3 as well. A couple of preliminary remarks about C.S. Lewis. First, as Christians, we're thankful that C.S. Lewis identified himself as a Christian. And while as evangelicals we may sometimes view Lewis as too broad, too ecumenical, too Catholic in his views, and more especially as Calvinists we may look with suspicion on the thinking and writing of C.S. Lewis more scrutinously even than as evangelicals. Nonetheless, we should be very thankful that C.S. Lewis was a Christian, that he identified himself as a Christian, and that we can properly set him within the camp of Christian thinkers. He's certainly a very important Christian thinker, perhaps one of the most of the 20th century. I had a thought about C.S. Lewis and intellectuals in general in preparation for this. An intellectual is someone who warps the light, someone who warps ideas, someone who turns ideas in just such a way as to make us see things not only a little differently, but perhaps also a little more clearly and even a little more deeply. C.S. Lewis is indeed an intellectual. He does warp ideas, and I think, as we see this evening, that he will cause us to look more deeply and hopefully more clearly at ideas. You should understand that in The Abolition of Man, Lewis is not writing explicitly as a Christian apologist. His apology for Christianity within The Abolition of Man is very subtle. And I think this is part of Lewis's evangelistic purpose as a literary philosopher, subtly cloaking or veiling his Christian message within a broader cultural and philosophical message. And thus our discussion this evening won't be about Christian theology per se or Christian scripture per se, but upon Lewis's broad cultural and philosophical sweep in this book as it relates to the topic, The Abolition of Man. I have several fellow panelists with me this evening. We have a college student, Stephen Sadowski. We have a physician, Dr. Cindy Sessions, and two businessmen to my right, Edward Cook and Steve Eichelman. And I'm thankful to have them fuel the fire with me in this discussion. We shall begin by laying out a premise for our discussion this evening. And let me try to put it for you in a nutshell. I think in The Abolition of Man, Lewis is aiming at one thing, and that at which he aims is a contrast between absolutism and relativism. And concomitant to absolutism and relativism, Lewis is aiming at objectivism, which is a brother to absolutism, and subjectivism, which is a brother to relativism. So the heart of the abolition of man is about absolutism versus relativism, objectivism versus subjectivism. That's the heart and core of his discussion. But the pretext upon which Lewis ensues onto that discussion is a story about two individuals who simultaneously were looking at a waterfall. And unbeknownst to them, the great poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge was standing in the periphery and observe them watching this waterfall. And as Coleridge observed them watch the waterfall, he overheard their comments about the waterfall. One of the individuals said, "This is sublime." The other individual said, "How pretty." Coleridge censured in disgust the second person who said, "How pretty," and approved only of the individual who said, exclamatorily, "This is sublime." Well, Lewis tells that story because he is reading a book on children's literature in which this story is related, the story of the two people at the waterfall, one who says it's sublime, one who says it's pretty, and Coleridge's judgment about that. However, the two authors of the children's book in which the story is related chide Coleridge for his castigation of one and appreciation of the other, and take a different twist on the story of the two people at the waterfall. The authors of the children's book say, the person who said this is sublime is not really making an objective commentary on the waterfall, but rather the person who said this is sublime is making a subjective reference to himself about how he feels about the waterfall, about what he thinks about the waterfall. In other words, the statement, this is sublime, is not necessarily, perhaps even not really, an objective description of the waterfall as sublime, but rather a subjective revelation of the person who made the comment. In other words, the waterfall may not or may be sublime, but the person who said this is sublime meant this is sublime to me. And thus these children's book authors say of the other person who said this is pretty that his statement is just as valid, and that therefore this is pretty tells us about person number two, not necessarily about the waterfall. So you see Lewis's point here. The meaning of the waterfall, its aesthetic qualities, are subjective to the observer. The first observer assigning sublimity to the waterfall, the second observer assigning prettiness to the waterfall. Subjective to individual experience. And like Coleridge, Lewis is very disturbed, not so much at the difference between this is sublime and this is pretty, but Lewis is disturbed that these children's book authors would be touting subjectivism and denying objectivity. In fact, denying the ability of a human being to make an objective, certifiable, absolute statement about the aesthetic quality of something like a waterfall. So, the issue for Lewis is absolutism versus relativism, objectivism versus subjectivism, told in the story of the two people at the waterfall and then the two authors writing a children's book. And so Lewis's observations become very important for education. His fear being that such authors of children's books will corrupt the thinking of children. Panel, any comment about that portion of the abolition of man?
You have been in education. Have you seen his predictions come true? Do you feel that education went that way or is going that way? Because I can truly say from my own experience, I feel like I was subjected to that, that I'm a product of that kind of teaching. And I'm delighted to see the school where my children are, that it's being reversed. Is it that concrete? Is it a concrete process that we see out there in education, a deliberate effort to move the child away from emotion?
When you say you were a product of that kind of education, do you mean in high school, college,
yes,
medical school?
I mean in high school and college in particular. Okay. Medical school, for sure, because things were focused on facts and tidbits and only certain areas of medicine were we encouraged to examine patients' feelings or their experience of things. But I definitely feel that in high school I was taught that my feelings are not important, feelings are not good, feelings are not artistic things, or are not yours, are not good. Let's go for a common good. Let's go for data. Let's go for instinct. It frightens me as I'm reading this book. I'm identifying with this. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, look, I think I really experienced that.
Mm-hmm. You're identifying with what Lewis is criticizing.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I have taught mostly in Christian schools, so my experience is derived largely from that. And
while I couldn't say that children in Christian schools are moral relativists, I think without question I can say they are aesthetic relativists, because I often teach upon the subject of beauty in Christian school settings, and children almost to a person will say that beauty is relative. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is definable by one's experience and opinion about beauty. And one person's opinion about beauty is just as valid as another person's opinion about beauty. Both can be right from their own perspective. So the doctrine of beauty is something that's very important to my dialogue with students. And in that sense, the aesthetic sense of what beauty means, I would say absolutely, even in Christian school settings, children are aesthetic relativists. And I would say not only is this a byproduct of the lack of aesthetic discernment in the contemporary church, it is certainly much broader than that in our culture. There's not a lot of aesthetic discernment in our culture, and there's certainly not a defense of aesthetic absolutism in our culture. So in that one area, the area of aesthetics, I would say students are rough. And I would add one other thing. I've also been a pastor for 32 years, and I've attended seminary and Bible college and know a little bit about God's Word. I think that relativism in aesthetic discernment is also applicable to theology in contemporary evangelicalism as well. In other words, as long as you are within the broad scope of evangelicalism, your opinion counts, even if your opinion X differs with opinion Y or Z. So I think there is a theological relativism within evangelicalism as well. Though I don't think so much a moral relativism. You know, ethics are easy. It's aesthetics and theology that are more difficult. And, you know, I think a democratic society that teaches the myth that all men are created equal cultivates in children, not to mention the post-50s, post-60s, James Dean, Elvis Presley, Beatles, Jimi Hendrix rebelliousness of children. But it cultivates in children a desire to want to be viewed as an equal with their parents or an equal with their teachers. And I think they carry this into adulthood, and I think there's generally a degeneration of respect to authority, particularly intellectual authority. And Lewis is taking a position as an intellectual authority here, and he's saying, wait just a minute. Relativism is wrong, subjectivism is wrong, absolutism and objectivity are right and true. Anyone else?
Comment or question for your comment, and that is, as a Christian, is there a hope of a revelational definition of beauty?
Yes. Yes, I think there is a revelational definition of beauty, and I think it is preeminently a moral definition. In Holy Scripture, beauty is often most associated with holiness. Absolute, impeccable, transcendental, moral purity. And I hesitate to even use moral, it's divine purity. So holiness is inseparable from beauty, is inseparable from holiness in Holy Scripture. But that is a Christian aesthetic, and is not necessarily a cultural aesthetic of art, and surely not a postmodern cultural aesthetic of art. But yes, I think holiness is inseparable from beauty in Scripture.
It'd be interesting to have a Lewis critique of Kierkegaardian effect on theology and relativism, subjectivism, and the mm-hmm. embrace of subjectivity. The neo-Orthodox movement.
Yeah, I think that inherently Lewis is critiquing Kierkegaard. In fact, I thought a lot about Kierkegaard while I was reading through The Abolition of Man, though I don't think Lewis writes with the force and power of Kierkegaard. Nonetheless, I think he is definitely antithetical to Kierkegaard and inherently challenging Kierkegaard, though he did not mention him per se. Well, the premise of Lewis's argument is couched within the broad scope of what Lewis calls the Tao, spelled T-A-O, but pronounced Tao. And upon reading that, one might think, well, here Lewis, supposedly a Christian, is writing from us from a Chinese or Buddhist tradition. You see, somehow ecumenical even beyond Christian boundaries, and I would say the answer to that is no. Lewis is trying to give us a profound idea in an umbrella term that might have appeal to people beyond the Christian parameter, but he nonetheless says that objectivity and absolutism are essentially the Tao. If you call it whatever you will, the philosophy of goodness, the philosophy of God, but Lewis defines it as the Tao. And a brief comment or two on the history of what the Tao means. Taoism is a philosophy which leads one to pursue a path of virtue. And that path of virtue is often achievable through magic. Lewis does allude to magic in the book The Abolition of Man, but I think for Lewis the ultimate meaning of magic in the Tao is moral magic, volitional magic, the magic of love, the magic of kindness, etc. Taoism is a philosophical slash religious idea that was
originated by Lao, L-A-O, Zhu, T-Z-U, Lao Zhu in the 6th century B.C. and has various strains in Confucianism and more especially Buddhism. But it is primarily a religion which quests for a path of virtue. And the essential idea of virtue for the Taoists is human kindness. And in the appendix to The Abolition of Man, Lewis lists 8 principles of the law of the Tao, or if you want to call it the law of human kindness. And they are as follows. General beneficence. General beneficence means kindness to all human beings. And Lewis quotes Jesus in that context, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Second law or principle of the Tao is special beneficence. That's when a father is kind to his son, a wife is kind to her husband, where some person of nearness unto you is the object of your beneficence. Third principle of the Tao, duties to parents, duties to the elderly, and duties to ancestors. And I'm ahead of myself here, but definitely Lewis's ideas, Dr. Sessions, have implications for the care of the elderly, medically and even euthanasia. So general beneficence, special beneficence, and duties to parents, elders, and ancestors. Fourth Taoist principle is justice. Fifth, acting with good faith and truthfulness. Sixth is mercy. And seventh is magnanimity. So those are the 7 laws of the Tao. Now, we'll come back to that in a few moments. Yes, sir.
I think you left out on the list duties to children and posterity.
And duties to children and posterity. Thank you. And that's very important as well. Now, one of the most important quotes in the work is from Augustine and his idea, ordo amoris. We would translate that roughly ordered love, or properly ordered love. And Augustine defines ordo amoris, properly ordered love, as, quote, the ordinate or proper condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love which is appropriate to it, unquote. I'll read it again. Ordo amoris is the proper condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love which is appropriate to it. In other words, my love has a proper order, or should have a proper order. It should have a proper order towards nature, a proper love towards my friends, a proper love towards my children, a proper love towards the stranger, the orphan, the widow, a proper love towards God. And the ordering of the soul, the order and more, the ordering of love in the soul is essentially parallel to the Tao. So when you hear Lewis's critique of the 2 men standing before the waterfall, one saying this is sublime, the other one saying this is pretty, their souls were ordered differently in their appreciation of the waterfall. Now, Coleridge said the person who said this is sublime was the better ordered soul. It might be arguable. Maybe a waterfall is not really sublime. Maybe it's really beautiful. Or maybe it's neither. But the fact is that the 2 individuals had different appreciations of the waterfall and therefore showed differently ordered souls. One had a certain level of love for the waterfall. The other had a different level of love. And then, when the 2 educators say those commentaries are not objective, this is sublime is not objective, this is pretty is not subjective, but rather subjective, and tell us more about the individual, you see how Lewis says that that kind of educational philosophy, relativism, subjectivism, immediately destroys 2 things. One, it destroys the reality of absolutes, And two, it destroys ordo amoris. It destroys love properly ordered in the soul. Comments?
I think in the things that we encounter today, it's interesting how Lewis refutes existentialism with this idea. Catholics have natural law theory, which has a lot of the same ideas. Paul talks about the nature of man and men having knowing innately certain things. He assigns an essence to man preceding existence, exactly the opposite of the popular idea today that existence precedes essence. And it's interesting how Christian the idea is without referring to Scripture.
Yeah, that raises an interesting point, one that I pondered while I was reading The Abolition of Man. Existence before essence versus essence versus before existence, correct? So the existential view is the waterfall is pretty, the waterfall is sublime. Take your pick. It's subjective and relative to the individual. The essential view is the waterfall is something. The waterfall is sublime, or the waterfall is pretty, or the waterfall is, but it's something. But that raised the question for me about Lewis and about his view of the Tao and about his view of humanity. And here I think we have to make a distinction. We have to give Lewis credit for believing in common grace. I thought of his discussion of natural law in Mere Christianity. Reality, ultimate meaning, if there is such a thing as an absolute, reality in ultimate meaning, I'm not sure is truly essential to the individual or to the species. Whereas I think Lewis and traditional Catholic theology would say there is an essential and universal consciousness of absolutism in certain specific areas, which Lewis called the Tao. And let's think about the waterfall for a moment. Let's say two other people were standing at the waterfall, and one said, "My, this is beautiful." And the other said, "My, this is sublime." And perhaps the third said, "My, this is violent." Well, if there's anything absolutely true about the waterfall, transcendent of physics, if there's any subliminal or aesthetic, cosmic truth to the waterfall, can we not theorize that the subliminal, aesthetic, cosmic meaning of the waterfall could transcend and be extraneous to the observations of the individual? In other words, they might not have the essential meaning of the waterfall in them. They may only be commenting existentially about the waterfall. So, does essence precede existence? Or is that a premise that only the Catholics take?
Well, my opinion would be that at least in certain things it does. My children may think something's beautiful that I don't think is beautiful. But they're not educated. But they know that it's not right to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And do they know that only because they've been taught it, or do they know it innately?
Mm-hmm.
I have an opinion about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that you can't convince someone who's not convinced, I believe.
Right, and there's where Lewis's argument from natural law and our crediting him with believing in common grace comes in. Universal moral consciousness of right and wrong through the inwritten law upon the heart, which to which the Scriptures attest. With pen of iron and point of a diamond, as it were, God writes His law upon the heart of all humanity, and gives humanity the mechanism of conscience to be sensitive to the law. If you look at the various qualities or precepts of the Tao, that inwritten moral consciousness would seem to be very compatible with Lewis's eightfold definition of the Tao: general beneficence to humanity, special beneficence to those nearer to us, duties to parents, elders, children, etc., justice, good faith, truthfulness, mercy, magnanimity. I suppose you could quibble with any or several of those, but Lewis has a point about moral sensitivity, and that's exactly what Lewis is getting at in the book. Is there or is there not such a thing as definable, immutable, and discernible morality in human beings? And that's what he feared about this children's book, that its affirmation of relativism and subjectivity would inherently undermine the view that there's real essence to something, and not only that there's real essence to something, but also that someone can make a valid, inarguable, objective, absolute, and correct observation about essence.
I think he's, at least in the first essay, he's very concerned, especially about the impact on the young. And there's an awesome quote at the end of the chapter. He says, "We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful."
Yes, that phrase "men without chests" gets to the heart of the matter. If I may visually illustrate this, or auditorially illustrate this for our viewers and listeners, imagine where you are sitting, or if you're looking at us, imagine us. What if our heads were attached to our abdomens and there was no chest in between? Now, we would be funny creatures indeed, would we not? And Lewis explains the relationship of the head to the chest to the abdomen in Platonic terms. In Plato's Republic, there are three people. There is the philosopher, who corresponds to the head. There is the proletariat, who corresponds to the body. And there is the policeman, who corresponds to the heart or conscience. You might say this is Freudian as well. There's the ego, the head, the id, the writhing body, and there's a superego, the conscience that it superimposes upon that. Well, in Lewis's individual here, you have a head, a chest, and an abdomen. Head, reason, the abdomen, the appetites. But the chest is ordo amoris, right ordered love. The chest is magnanimity. And Lewis believes, correctly so, that educationally, our culture, and certainly you could broaden that to mean not only educationally, but ethically and politically and economically, that our culture is creating men without chests. Men with heads, men with abdomens, but men with no hearts, no magnanimity, no virtue, as it were. And the reason why the chest is cut out is because the absolutism and the objectivity of virtue is denied. And how can you have a heart without objectivity, without absolutism, without virtue? Comment?
He makes the comment that the task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts, to help. I appreciate your comments on that, particularly, too, that the he's fighting against this trend toward labeling the youth as sentimental and trying to get that out of them. And the danger in that is they want to replace it with something else. And so he says that if we starve that sensibility, we're just going to make them open prey for whatever else, the tide of whatever else can be taught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by sentiment, I think, and by sentimentalism, Lewis means magnanimity. He means kindness and virtue. As if education has nothing to do with that. And really, if you look at the typical secular school, what does it have to do with magnanimity? Altruism, perhaps, sort of a communal magnanimity, but individual affirmation of virtue and absolute ethics doesn't educate that way.
When I was in high school, I was in elected to this group called Values Clarification.
Huh.
I don't know if you've any experience with this, but this group got several sophomores and juniors together and told us that basically it didn't matter what our belief system was,
right,
as long as we could clearly state it. And we even went around to junior high schools and taught kids in turn. We turned around and taught them.
And this was in South Carolina?
Yes, it was. In South Carolina.
Hmm.
That it doesn't matter what your belief system is. As long as you really can state it and you're consistent, then it can be whatever you want it to be, as long as people can identify that with you.
Right, and you hear that in popular culture, such as mm-hmm. songs, Frank Sinatra, "I Did It My Way."
And they sing that at funerals.
And they sing that at funerals, right. Yeah, and that does get to the heart of a question about education, which Dr. Noggle is going to be lecturing to us about. And that is the purpose of education to be the inculcation of absolutes and objectivity and not mere ideals, but virtue itself? And of course, as Christians, we're going to say absolutely the purpose of education is virtue. And really, if you think about Plato's Republic, to which Lewis alluded several times, the purpose of the Republic was the virtuousness of its citizenry. Certainly, the Republic of Plato wanted its citizens to eat, but it wanted its citizens to live well. It wanted its citizens to live respectfully of others. And, you know, one could argue, though I think it certainly overstressed to the point of our losing the force and power of it, one could argue that our culture is extremely denigrated, that children, young adults, and adults who've been educated in a non-ethical, non-virtuous, non-magnanimous educational setting are men without chests. They have heads, they have appetites, but they have no hearts. And that's why some of us put our children in Christian schools, or if we can't afford private school education, certainly we do our best at home to inculcate Christian values in our children. And I think here, in defense of parents who have their children in public schools, I think we have to be careful to say that, well, so what if the public school taught virtue? Could it? Can the state teach virtue? And of course, I'm very much libertarian on those kinds of issues. I'm neither too loyal nor comfortable to or with the state. So I'm not sure I want the state teaching virtue. Democratic virtue, ethical virtue, perhaps, not ultimate virtue. That's the responsibility of the parents. But it does bring you to a philosophy of, you know, who is an educator? Just like the person who can judge art. If beauty is inseparable from holiness, then who can judge art? Or who could do art? well, if virtue is inseparable from a good education, who can do education? You know, we're very getting very close to becoming post-millennialists here. Men without chests. It's a very powerful image, is it not?
It's a little, when you think about it, in the statement you made about the generation of men without chests and the history of American Republic was created with men with chests, and
yes.
Now the reins are held by men without chests. And so we see, I believe, ignoramuses who don't understand ideas, who have no idea what they're dealing with.
And that was Lewis's fear in the book. The way he illustrated this was in the context of our responsibility to exercise special beneficence to our children, especially because our children are our posterity. They are the future. So you must handle with special care children. And if you fail to educate them magnanimously, virtuously, then you're handing to your posterity, your future, a horrible epitaph. And beyond that, Lewis said, it is we who are now, this isn't a quote, but a paraphrase, it is we who exist now who have the power of destiny over future generations. And that was especially terrifying for Lewis in this book, because he said when relativism rules the contemporary culture, the subsequent culture will be the product, will be the artifact of the contemporary culture. And if our culture is now led with men without chests, it will create an artifact of the future. It will be a despicable and virtuousless culture. Lewis tied this to man's power over nature. If you recall, he said, he quoted a friend of his who said, and I'm sure this was in the 40s or 50s, he said, quote, this is a British fellow, said, quote, man has whacked nature, unquote. And I'm sure that was post-World War II, post-atomic bomb, post-other scientific discoveries. Man has whacked nature. And Lewis pointed out, ironically, that fellow was dying of tuberculosis. An irony. But Lewis said, you know what? We have whacked nature. We're almost complete lords over nature, except one element. And the nature, the element of nature over which we are not lords, Lewis said, is human nature. And that's where the danger lies, that when we cannot have power over our own natures and make ourselves men without chests, then we are in fact destroying the future generation. And he used contraception, birth control, as an example of that. He said when a society widely practices birth control, which is really selective breeding, and of course selective breeding for Lewis was just prophylactics. The birth control pill was not yet invented. Certainly abortion was available in Britain during his time. But now, with the advent of birth control, now way beyond what Lewis thought, with genetic experimentation with human beings and cloning, the potential of cloning of human beings, selective breeding is beyond Hitler's wildest dream. But ever how we choose to selective breed, Lewis says, we are predestinating the next culture to be, as it were, conformed in our image. Again, a terrible prospect when not only are we men without chests, but we're going to be breeding selectively children whom we're going to teach after our own mind and according to our own image.
It struck me, what you're making there, that Lewis, I believe this book was written in 1947. Mm-hmm. he died in 1963, and it is, as you say, contraception wasn't as we know it then, certainly. And even, I guess, education wasn't as we know it. And I'm reading this book, and I'm thinking, my idea of contraception is certainly different than his idea of contraception. And it's almost as if I got the idea of his being sort of a prophet, in the sense mm-hmm. of he's writing in 1947 something that happens. I don't mean to personalize this too much, but I could see some of his ideas coming through in my own education in high school in the 70s. So it struck me his wisdom on this. It's coming true, exactly what he said was going to happen.
I felt the same thing, that he was writing prophetically, and I don't mean the sense of divine inspiration, but as an intellectual sharply looking into the future. I do think he wrote prophetically in that vein, and he's so postmodern in his observations. I was struck by that.
Another example is, not being a philosopher, I may not state this very well, but he gives the example of a man without a chest. What do you base your actions on? And he says, you do it for sentiment? No, you don't have that. You can't do it because it's pretty. You can't do it because it's good. So ultimately, it comes down that your actions are governed by instinct. Well, that was 1947. Well, what do people say now about homosexuality?
Mm-hmm.
Is that men and women are behaving as they are born to, that it's instinctual. And that really struck me as, there he goes again. I mean, he's stating what we are seeing now come to pass.
Yeah, he makes the point, when the mind, which is the head, is motivated by the belly, the appetite, that you have an animal. You don't have a man. What makes a man is the chest. What makes the chest is virtue, goodness, truth, beauty, absolutes, beneficence, all those things. And when minds are governed principally by instinct, they have no basis of motivation, no basis of evaluation, because they have denied the very thing that makes the chest. They have denied the heart. They have denied love. They've denied beauty. They've denied truth. Right, wrong, all that. And so, therefore, it's completely amoral instinct that moves the mind. And whatever moves the mind moves the culture. And again, for Lewis, that was so significantly dangerous, because the mind that moves the culture shapes the future through the education of children.
Just to regress for a second?
Certainly.
To go back on the laws of Tao.
Law of Tao.
Right. Can you elaborate as to why Lewis would choose that versus some other moral, ethical, or religious codes of conduct in this book?
That's a very good question, and I wonder that. And maybe I can explain it a little bit in light of the appendix. First of all, I think by choosing the topic of the Tao as the paradigm for his discussion of virtue, truth, etc., Lewis is veiling his strong Christian perspective, though he does state explicitly in the book, "I am a Christian and I'm writing from a Christian perspective." He does say that in two sentences, in fact. But I think if you come out of the gate advocating virtue to from a Christian perspective to a non-Christian audience, they write you off pretty easily. So perhaps, and this is speculative on my part, perhaps Lewis has chosen the idea of the Tao because it's globally broad. It's ancient. It's ancient as Judeo ethics is almost a little more ancient than Christian ethics. So I think perhaps to neutralize the voice of the critic who might be saying, well, he's just preaching from Christianity standpoint. That's speculative on my part. So the global or cultural breadth of it. The second reason I think he might use that is because of Lewis's strong emphasis upon natural law. In Mere Christianity, he devotes much discussion to natural law, and Lewis rightly, I believe, affirms that there is moral consciousness in humanity. So by pulling from the Tao, the Oriental tradition of virtue, Lewis is affirming the globalness or the globalism of virtue, not merely from a Christian perspective or a Jewish perspective, but from an Oriental perspective as well. So for those two reasons, I think. One, to neutralize the adverse reaction of the reader for whom Lewis might be too preachy, and two, to globalize the discussion. But I will say this, in the appendix, he did a masterful job, too, of conglomerating quotes from all kinds of religious and philosophical traditions. He uses Babylonian texts, he uses Jewish texts, non-biblical Jewish texts, biblical Jewish texts, he uses Christian texts, he uses philosophical texts. So I think Lewis is pulling not only on cultural tradition, but also on the doctrine of common grace and general revelation in choosing the Tao as its paradigm.
I think that also points out, he points out that there's really no new virtues. You know, we can't think of anything new.
Yeah.
That it's all been around, and even Jesus didn't have anything in the sense of morals. He didn't have anything new to express, and so he even quotes Norse mythology.
Mm-hmm.
It's everywhere. Look at it, and then if you're trying to deny this, you can't just say it's a Christian thing. I mean, you're denying everybody's culture if you try to take that Tao out of people. You know, try to take it out of our kids and out of our.
Yeah, and I think this is really problematic for us in a Marxist Darwinist world. Both Marxism and Darwinism have only one virtue, and that is altruism. What is good for one is good for all. An atheist has no basis upon which to act beneficently to other human beings except if he chooses existentially to be an altruist. Albert Camus, the great French writer, deals with this in almost all of his novels. If there is no God, then what's my responsibility to my fellow man? Well, one can choose, like Hitler chose, to simply run over my fellow man and get my way, or one can choose to love. And really, that's kind of a very empty, anemic, this is politically incorrect, and effeminate virtue to say, oh, well, there's no such thing as love, but I'll choose love. There's no such thing as beneficence, but I'll choose beneficence. There is no God, but I'll be nice. That's the only virtue that a Darwinist or a Marxist or an atheist has. And, of course, Lewis is definitely confronting those things head on, though I think Lewis is probably open to some kind of evolution in other of his writings. But how absolutely terrifying. And here, you know, for Christians, as Christians, I think, wow, the rule of law for us becomes very important. Because if society is not ruled by law, whether society thinks that law is based in absolutes or not is irrelevant. I need law for my protection from this society. Very, very important. And that's one of the things he mentions. Listen, quote, a dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary to the very idea of a rule which is not tyranny, or an obedience which is not slavery. Unquote. And then Dr. Sessions, to your point, next to the last quote here, stepping outside the Tao, they have stepped into the void. That's powerful. Nor are their subjects necessarily unhappy men. They are not men at all. They are artifacts. Man's final conquest has proved to be the abolition of man. So man's ultimate power of nature will be self-destruction. Moral self-destruction, aesthetic self-destruction, and perhaps even military self-destruction. Closing comments from anyone? Stephen.
Going back to that, I guess, subject of, like, you know, education, public, mm-hmm. public education, it does seem like there are some, it seems like they choose a few of those maybe points from the Tao to maybe to argue for, like, for instance, you know, environmentalism, you mm-hmm. know, preserving mm-hmm. the earth for mm-hmm. our posterity. Mm-hmm. And it does also seem like in college, maybe not so much like for my classes, but just the setting, you know, like there's all these things, you know, like for instance when the tsunami came,
yes.
you know, a lot of organizations
yes.
were, you know, wanting to, you know, donate, you know, mm-hmm. collect donations for mm-hmm. those people over there.
Yeah, one could say that those very things prove Lewis's point, that there is this objectively identifiable human consciousness that is sensitive to others, and in times of crisis that threshold of the appearance of that consciousness narrows, and we see it in a tsunami, or we see it when the earth is threatened by the greenhouse effect. So I certainly agree with Lewis's point that this moral consciousness is universal in human beings, and that it attests to common grace and general revelation. And I think you make an excellent point that crisis magnifies the reality of that. You think about September 11th, how morally conscious our nation got, how religious we are, how sentimental we all got in the midst of that. And as soon as the crisis was over, what happened?
Mm-hmm. In a sense, Christmas does the same kind of thing.
Oh, awesome point. Elaborate. Christmas.
Christmas. Warm, good feelings, goodwill toward men, misquoting scripture.
Yeah.
doing benevolences, taking
yeah.
food to the hungry so
yeah.
people can, quote, have a good Christmas.
Yeah.
We have so much, let's share at Christmas.
Yeah. It is, and that's why sometimes Christians, we're pretty reserved about what we think about cultural Christmas. But it does also, like a tragedy. So we can say tragedies, holidays, emphasize or lower the threshold of a manifest moral consciousness. Anything else? Any other holidays or tragedies you can think of where that's true? Or any other cultural phenomena? Well, children always get your attention, don't they? I mean, orphans and the poor. Well, for our listeners and viewers, we hope you've enjoyed the discussion. Feel free to send us your comments via email. And again, we want to encourage you to listen or view our upcoming conference with Drs. Dan Russ and David Noggle and Pastor Brad Mercer, all of whom will be lecturing on C.S. Lewis and or Dorothy Sayers. That's April 30th, 9:30 a.m., 10:30 a.m., and May 1st. 9:30 a.m., 10:30 a.m. And God willing, over the next few months, we'll be coming to you again on Wednesday evenings with discussions about other topics of interest. And we hope that you will join us. And I want to say thank you for my friends and my fellow panelists being here this evening. Any closing remark? Well, thank you all and good night.